As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Discover a new educational and interactive podcast, Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids. Our episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We went shape hunting around the block, and we found spheres and cubes on the street.
That was great fun. Join Stories for Kids, the Lingo Kids podcast, inspiring you to learn while having fun. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott.
And I'm Ben. As always, we are joined by our super producer, Noel Brown. I was recently listening to a previous episode we did on The Fair Lady. And one of the things that's strange about that episode, Scott, is that we spend the first few minutes doing our best not to make our guest producer Matt's nickname the Fair Lady.
Really? Yeah, I can kind of remember that. It seems like it was a while ago now. Maybe even
in August,
couple months,
maybe
something like that. Yeah. Boy, I guess we should probably make the same effort for Noel.
Yeah, we should definitely not call him Noel the Fair Lady Brown.
Yeah, definitely not. Listeners want to do that. No, they shouldn't do that. I'm just joking. But maybe we should. Z seems too easy, right?
Z's a cool name, though.
Yeah, I guess it is. Maybe we should think about this one throughout the episode and then come back later.
That's a good idea.
If we remember, to come up with a nickname.
So, by way of segue, ladies and gentlemen, the conversational feint, not the weird vehicle. Do you remember the segue?
Rising Sun.
Rising Sun.
How about that?
How about that? That's not a bad one, Noel Rising Sun Brown.
These might strike me throughout the episode like that, so we'll see.
Okay, yes.
All right.
So just by way of segue, though, we were talking just before we went on the air about how rare the subject of today's podcast can be.
Yeah, you know? Because I think I mentioned in the other one, and I haven't listened to it recently, like in the last month or so, but I remember saying that on my way to work, occasionally I'll see a Z car. And when I say Z car, I know that means cars that go through present day. I get that there's a modern version of this. But I'm talking about particularly the cars from the 1970s. And I think that's our main focus today. We're going to get to the modern versions too, but our main focus will be the 1970s vehicles. And I think I said something like I see like three or four or five on the way to work every day.
Mm-hmm.
I've been paying attention to this in the last couple weeks just because I knew this was coming up. And I think that number is down to about two a day. I'm seeing only about two of these a day now. And that's not terrible, I guess, when you consider that, you know, it's a four-decade-old vehicle. However, it's the same two that, you know, were in with the other four or five that I saw before. But we don't really have the seasons here in Atlanta like we do, elsewhere in the United States, you know, where it gets cold and you put away your summer toy.
Right.
It's typically, everything goes all year. I mean, you could ride a motorcycle nearly 365 days a year here. So,
it snowed that one time.
that one year it did snow. That's right. We had that ice storm. But
right.
No, seriously, we just don't have the seasons where you put away your summer toy. So it's kind of strange to me that people would put away those toys because apparently they have, or maybe they've moved out of the region. I don't know.
Those are both possible. In our one thing we did in our previous podcast on the Fair Lady was that we explored, we explored the rise of the Fair Lady, and then we started getting to Z cars. And this was this was inspired by a letter from a listener, Jimmy from LA, right?
Right. And so this will be kind of a continuation of the Nissan Datsun sports car Fair Lady, Z Car story. I mean, it's all right. Jumbled together, and we'll try to sort all that out. But, you know, along the way, after we did that Fair Lady episode, we had a bunch of listeners that wrote in with mm-hmm. different Z Car stories, photos of their Z Cars.
Oh, yeah.
You know, modern and old. And just to kind of laundry list a few of these here.
Sure.
We had a listener named Patrick A. that wrote in and said he has a 1972 Datsun 240Z. Oh, also a 76 Trans Am in his garage. Mm-hmm. That both of them need full restoration. He sent a lot of photos along with that as well, so yeah. Thanks for that. And Rudy Smith wrote in and said that he at one time had a 280ZX in the past, and he mentioned this, and I thought this was a good way to sum it up. He always sums up things pretty nicely, but he said it was a classic GT car with a large used car market, and it was affordable for a lot of people. That's why you saw so many of them. That's why they're so popular. And we'll talk about that along the way, too. Just incredible dealer networks that were put into place in order to sell this car, which other, outside manufacturers like, and I say outside, I mean import manufacturers like Jaguar and BMW didn't have at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Jimmy from L.A. wrote back in to say thanks for the first episode also, and he mentioned one other quick thing. He said that I mentioned that I don't really like convertibles somewhere along the way. And I think I've said that many times in this,
that's true.
In this podcast.
Yeah.
And the reason I don't like them particularly is because when you sit at a stoplight or a stop sign, you tend to bake in the sun. It's just uncomfortable. It's
sure.
hot. People are looking at you. I just don't like it all that much. But he said, I wonder if this would change anything. You know, the Z cars from the 1990s and actually going back farther than that in the 1980s, they had T-tops. And that's a good point. You know, mm-hmm. I'd probably still drive a Z car even though it had T-tops. I had a old Trans Am had T-tops, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, you mentioned that before.
I have had one convertible. It was that old MG, but different story, different podcast.
Different time.
Here's the last one that I'll mention, and this has kind of a little side note to it as well, Ben.
Okay.
And something that I think listeners will find interesting. And then we'll get into our topic for today, I promise. Mark D. from Australia writes in and said, we didn't mention the Datsun P510, which is also called the Datsun 1600 mm-hmm. over in Australia.
Yeah.
And he said that was his first car, and it was a fairly popular model. In fact, it was fairly popular on that continent. You know, everybody, not everybody, but lots of people had them, had a lot of success in rally competitions, and he wrote in, you know, some specifics about that. So maybe we should cover the Datsun P510 at some point in the future. But, and I just need to mention this because this is,
sure.
this is the side note.
Okay.
Not Mark D, but other Australians have written in about the Dodge Deora. And I know, yeah, see, I knew this
great.
Would make you laugh, but,
yeah. What's the verdict?
Well, this is odd, but from Australia, for the most part, they don't like it. And we're getting responses back and forth about people
sure,
who do
sure.
and don't like it, right?
Yeah.
We haven't really tallied everything yet, but, I was surprised by the Australians that said they don't like it because it has a ute look to it. It looks a lot like a sport ute.
Yeah.
And to me, I mean, well, we know that Australians love their sport utility vehicles.
Oh, for
right?
sure,
they're,
yeah.
Not sport utility, but the utes, I guess,
uh-huh.
The car front end and the truck back end. Mm. And I was really surprised by the reaction to the Deora.
I kind of am, too, because I would have assumed that it would be a similar enough concept, not a similar vehicle, really, but a similar enough concept that people might embrace it. But also, man, Scott, literally the only thing that I think is cool about it is that front hatch opening.
Okay, fine. I know your side of this whole thing.
Oh yeah, you don't need me to say it again.
I was just surprised, and I know Noel's side of it too, by the way. But I was surprised by the Australian response. Now I know that's broad brush, you know, to say that
sure.
all Australians love their youth.
Sure,
but,
sure.
But still, come on.
We got some responses on Twitter where people were saying, whatever, I think it's cool. And then some people were saying, you know, I think it's both ugly as sin and great.
Yeah, it's weird. It's weird that way. Now,
it's a divisive car.
You don't get many that say that because usually it's I hate it or I love it.
Right, yeah.
So, I don't know. Okay, maybe, Ben, we should get into our topic for today. How about that? Are we like 7-8 minutes into the show or something?
Oh, man, you know what, though? That's fine with me because we're discussing important things.
Part of the fun.
Part of the job, my friend.
All part of the fun. Now, you're going to hear a lot of paper turning from my side of the mm-hmm. table because I've got a lot of notes, which are, again, continuation from our Fair Lady podcast. And I guess we'll begin right in 1969 with the Nissan S30 cars.
Oh, yes, yes. The famous S30. Now, this is something, listeners, that we this is one of the things that people wrote to us about, right, Scott, and said, hey, guys, how are you going to do the Fair Lady without talking about this? The previous episode we did was one of those episodes where we walked out still with half our notes. You know?
Sure, sure. And this is the beginning of the traditional, or what you call the Z cars, I guess.
Right, yeah. It's the first generation from 1969 to 78, right?
Yeah.
And the S30 had a team of designers. They were led by a guy named Yoshihiko Matsuo, and this was the head of the sports car styling studio at the time, Nissan's studio.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, for every fan of Z cars, you're saying, hey, wait a second, there's a different person whose name I remember, the famous Mr. K.
Yeah, Mr. K, and his name was Yutuka Katayama. Mm-hmm. And I'll try not to say that as many times as I can today. I'll say Mr. K if possible. But I got to make maybe one possible correction, and I'm not entirely sure that I did this right or not. I think in my original notes I said the president of Nissan Motor Corporation was his name is Mr. Katsuchi Kawamata, and I think I called him Mr. K early on, but that's not the true Mr. K. Now, Mr. K, again, as I said, was Mr. Katayama, and he's the one, and I think I did say this correctly, he's the one who lived to be age 105, and he died just this year in 2015.
Unfortunately, yeah.
Yeah, but he was responsible for the October 1969 launch in the United States, so in America, and I think one other quick thing that we need to mention here, Ben, is that
sure,
even though this car launched in 1969, and I think it was a 1970 model year, and we're talking about what was really the Datsun 240Z, the car was, the beginning of this whole thing was in 1966, and the idea was to design a compact GT car that would have performance and comfort that would, as one person put it, outrun its performance, which I like,
yes,
the way they say that.
Yeah,
that it would be like a level above the way they're going to price this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to feel comforts or creature comforts above the way it's priced. And the prototype was built in 1966, and that would eventually become the 240Z in 1970. And that's when it launched, or 1969 as a 1970 model year.
Right. And this goes through a couple different variants. There's later it becomes the 260Z, then the 280Z, but all of the variants have a couple things in common, right?
Yeah. First is that they're all Nissan S30 cars.
Yes. That is the most important one.
Kind of an umbrella number.
Mm-hmm. And they all have, for instance, McPherson struts in the front, Chapman struts in the back. They have independent suspension. But when we get down into the variants themselves, I don't know, how far into this do you want to go?
Well, you know
how
what?
Far down this rabbit hole, Scott?
Let's walk through each model, maybe,
okay,
the 1970s. And I think we'll focus, again, mainly on the 1970s.
Yeah.
And we'll get to the modern ones, but maybe with less detail, because I think the interest here, the main interest, is the 1970 vehicles, the true Z cars.
Yeah. So,
and I shouldn't
Ooh,
say...
you might be burning some bridges, my friend.
Okay, I take that back, listeners. I didn't mean to say the true Z cars. I mean the first iteration of these things.
The one and, true Z car.
Yeah, and I should even say that. I mean, we're talking like the first... I mean, let's talk about maybe the first three generations of Z cars in detail and then move on from there.
Agreed, because I really want to see what you think about the most recent Z cars. And listeners, I want to hear what you think about these two. And tell me, Scott, I promise this is the last time I'll mention this, but tell me if you think they are true Z cars.
Oh, don't pigeonhole me like that.
I'm not.
I didn't mean it that way. Yeah, just what I meant was the focus is on the original Z cars.
The OGZs.
I like it. I really like that.
All right.
Oh, OG. Maybe that's Noel OG
Oh,
Brown.
Nice.
Yeah, maybe.
Oh, okay. He nodded. That's the Noel. That's the first nickname from today that you nodded at.
Yeah. All right. Well.
Oh, okay. You heard the other ones? This guy.
Yeah. Who knows? All right. So let's start walking through the Nissan S30 cars, beginning with the 240Z. Now, it's important to note that the 240Z was Datsun's halo car at the time. So it was one of those cars that they put in the showroom, and they know that you come to look at it because it was all new and exciting, and it was their sport GT car. But there's a good chance you're not going to walk out with that one. You're going to probably walk out with something, some other model that Nissan Datsun was putting out at the time.
Right.
And, production of this whole thing, this particular vehicle went from about 1969 to 1973. And, one quick thing. You mentioned a few things that they all had in common.
Yeah.
There were a lot of things like that. And as we get to the specs, I'll try to point a few of those out because I have a few marked here. But you said something about the Chapman struts.
Mm-hmm. Chapman struts in the rear.
Yeah, those come from, as you may guess, from Colin Chapman of mm-hmm. Lotus. He designed those. So that's a Lotus design rear suspension on those early cars. And another thing that I want to mention here is that every one of these vehicles came equipped with either an inline six or a V6 engine through the modern day.
Yeah.
So going back in history of the Z cars, you'll never find one with a four-cylinder engine, or you'll never find one with an eight-cylinder engine that mm-hmm. came from the factory that way. Now, I know a lot of people shoehorn different things into those cars.
Right, right.
And there's turbo variations, of course, along the way, but they're all inline six or V6 engines from 1969 through present day.
Mm-hmm. So if we – the 1970 through about – well, I'd say halfway through 1971, 240Z was called the Series 1. And they have a lot of differences that are kind of cosmetic, kind of subtle, maybe. Yeah. But the most easily visible one is the badging, of course, 240Z, and these horizontal vents in the rear hatch, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. And that's not the only thing. There was another cosmetic difference that was actually, well, you know, I shouldn't say cosmetic, also functional difference.
Okay.
For the U.S. vehicles, the bumpers and emission controls devices were a lot different. So you got to remember that we were going through that fuel crisis era, you know, where there were fuel rationing here in the United States mm-hmm. and the oil embargoes and all that. And so as this story plays out, you're going to see a lot of emissions control devices added to these vehicles, and it chokes the performance right out of these cars.
Oh,
and
I'm sure that
Datsun, Nissan, and the consumers were very upset by this, because as we go through here, I can tell you different horsepower numbers and torque numbers.
Oh,
and,
for sure.
You know, the prices and the weights and all that, it all plays back into, and not all of it, most of it plays back into emissions control devices that were necessary at the time. You know, these stringent U.S. emissions controls.
And, that stuff is still happening today, of course, as we know. But the weight is going to be really interesting as we go through this, because it shifts.
Oh, tremendously.
Right.
I've got a few notes about that, too. It's let's do
some specs for the 240 first.
Sure.
So one of the most interesting things to me about the 240 is it has two valves per cylinder.
Yes.
Isn't that weird?
Well, it seems weird now.
Right.
But then it wasn't. And that's why you got to look at this. You have to look at it through the lens of 1970 mm-hmm. and understand that, you know, it wasn't crazy to have, two valves per cylinder. It wasn't crazy to have a single overhead cam. But, they also had cast iron blocks, and they had drum brakes in the rear.
Right.
Some weird things along, you look at it now and think, like, well, why did they do it that way? But, again, 1970.
Mm-hmm.
And the strange thing is they carried it all the way through the 1970s. They could have upgraded to disc brakes, but I think they were doing it in order to keep the cost down. So to keep it, true to the original idea that, here's a modern style vehicle that outruns
its price.
Oh, very good, Ben. Yeah, we remember.
Yeah, I remember the thing from a few minutes earlier.
I barely remember that.
Actually, we did a retake on that one.
Oh, you're letting all of our secrets out. And Ben, another thing we need to talk about is probably the transmissions, because sort of limited at first, but along the way we'll have more and more options available.
Right. So when it first comes out, it is the only thing you can get in 1970 is the 4-speed manual transmission at first, right?
Yep. And then they added a 5-speed manual and later a 3-speed automatic, which was available after September of 1970. Now, this one comes with a specific badge. It says mm-hmm. Nissan Full Automatic, the badge. It's like a special thing. It was not a rare option or anything like that.
Sure.
But I doubt many people went for the automatic option.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about this, too. And listeners, chime in as well. What do you think about that? Because to me, this seems like a car that needs to be stick.
Yeah, and this is back in the day when you were better off driving a manual transmission. Now that we have, the modern automatics that are more efficient, are shifting faster than
that
you can
optimize. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So this is, again, this is decades before automatic transmissions got to the point they are now. So remember that, it was a better option really for a lot of reasons at that time.
Mm-hmm. And speed wise, pretty good. Pretty good speed wise. 125 miles per hour tops out at 0 to 60 in a flat 8 seconds.
Yeah, 8 seconds. Now that's surprising because, well, It is, I guess. You know,
for the
again,
time.
Again, for the time. Yeah, we keep saying that. Maybe we shouldn't have to keep saying that. But eight seconds now, I kind of consider 6 seconds about the cutoff, or like you're moving along pretty good.
Sure, sure.
I guess in 1970, 8 seconds wasn't all that bad compared to, you know, other vehicles that were, you know, in the 12 or 13 or 15 second range, 0 to 60. Not too bad at all.
I mean, these cars just look so cool.
And fuel consumption kind of surprised me. Now, I guess it's probably because there's a cast iron V6 under the hood.
Right.
But being aerodynamic as it was and small as it was,
yeah.
And, well, I guess maybe the sportiness trades off a little bit on this, but the typical fuel consumption was about 21 miles per gallon at the time. Now, we've talked about fuel economy in the past, and there were some pickup trucks at the time that were getting 67, 69.
It's crazy.
71 miles per gallon.
It's something, I don't know how you guys feel about it, but it is as if so much of the rest of the world forgot that those used to be the kind of fuel consumption numbers we would see, you know, because you would hear people, or excuse me, by people, I mean manufacturers, saying, wow, look at this amazing car that gets almost 20 miles per gallon because of these new innovations. And I'm sitting here thinking, you guys, not to be a jerk, but do you remember the cars you were making in the 60s and the 70s?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, three times that number.
Oh, easily, sometimes.
Yeah, which is crazy. Yeah, sometimes. But maybe it has something to do with weight, too. You know, we can talk about weight if you want now,
yes.
Or we can hang on, because I think maybe there's a point later that weight becomes even more critical.
Yeah.
So let's move on.
Okay.
From the 240Z to the 260Z, which was available. This is an oddball.
This is an oddball because if you were a resident of the U.S., you could buy it in 1974.
Yeah, that's it.
That's just the only year.
1 year only for the U.S. The rest of the world, the other markets.
Everybody else.
Everybody else got it from 1974 through 1978. So there was an additional 3 years where we couldn't have it, but everybody else could.
All right, I'm going to set you up for this one, my friend.
Mm-hmm.
So why did that happen?
Well, it was emissions. As we mentioned earlier, right? It was just, there were just too many emissions emissions issues that kept them from continuing with the 260 line here in the United States. And I'll just give you an example of why. Now, the I think the engine was enlarged, right? So the engine was enlarged to 2.6 liters displacement. Now, the previous one, what did it have? 2.4 liters displacement? I think that was, right?
Yeah, around there.
Yeah, something like that. And, no, it was. It was 2.4 liters. And so they enlarged this engine. Mm-hmm. They called it the L26 instead of the L24 like they did before, so it makes sense, right?
And not to get too political, but Uncle Sam comes in and says, you've got to reduce your ignition timing and compression ratio to hit the emission standards.
Yeah.
But this lowers the power output.
Yes. Serious consequence with the horsepower output. And that lowered, the power output to 140 horsepower. And here's where the frustrating part is. The rest of the world, you know, the other markets, the same engine, the same package, everything except for the U.S. emissions packages that were on these cars.
Yeah.
Allowed them to get 165 horsepower. So you're talking about 25 additional horsepower in a car that only has 140 to begin with. That's a lot. That's a huge increase percentage wise.
Yeah, but they didn't give up, because Datsun, about partway through, you know, the one you hear called the 1974.5 model, that had the full 165 horsepower, but it also had this addition of these 5 mile per hour safety bumpers. And later, you know, we'll see that play into the 280.
Yeah, that's coming up very soon, I promise. But, you know, can I just mention, we talked about the 1975 and these safety bumpers and all this.
Yeah.
There's another little interesting side note, I think, that in late 1974, the US 260Z models, which were sometimes, as you said, the 74 and a half models.
Right.
Carried these heavier bumpers that remained in place for the 280Z, and that was all part of a new United States bumper legislation that was enacted in 1973, and that's where we got all those kind of crazy big rubber bumpers that were on cars. And a lot of people lament that, even now, that, you know, the old chrome bumper designs went over to these big plastic bumpers, and it, in a lot of ways, it harmed the styling of sports cars and sedans and everything along the way, luxury cars, everything.
And, you know, I am sure, Scott, that there is a safety calculation there.
Of course.
Right. And so do we choose style over safety? Okay, here's the thing. I was thinking about this earlier. Why we're so many style cues have been lost to time because of safety or regulation. I'm not saying that regulation is bad by any means. What I am saying though is that it's sad. And when we were doing our episode on the Aurora safety car, aka the Smiling Jackass, which also has very good intentions, of course. Remember how they had that big scoop bumper, and the idea was that they could just scoop someone up instead of breaking their legs?
Sure, it was like a concave cow catcher.
Right.
Instead of the the cow catchers normally push them off to the side, but this is actually a true catcher, like a pedestrian catcher.
So here's my question, though. We were both fairly skeptical about the safety bumper's actual capability to be safe.
Yeah.
So my question is, if someone's already getting hit by a car, how much safer is that rubber bumper?
Well, this 5 mile per hour thing that they've got, you know, the rubber bumpers with the absorbers and everything, I think that was more of a low speed traffic thing.
Okay. So that you would just be kissing fenders.
Exactly right. Yeah. It wouldn't cause such damage. And not only that, it reduces shock to the people inside in low speed conditions.
Yeah.
Now, I know if you're going 35 or 40, that really doesn't matter at all. It doesn't take away 5 miles per hour from the impact or anything like that.
Right, right.
It doesn't work that way. It's that if you're at a low speed and you bump into somebody, the people inside maybe won't get whiplash. You know, that's probably the situation they're talking about.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, so I see you're getting back at me for that one true Z-car thing. implying that I want everyone to have whiplash.
Yeah, please, Ben, please stop talking about the true Z car. I didn't mean it. I really didn't mean it.
You know what? I'm being such a Benedict Arnold right now because I did just promise that I wouldn't bring it up again.
Can I move on with this one then, please?
Anything
to get past that.
I just want to say, ladies and gentlemen, I don't want people to have whiplash just like chrome bumpers.
Sounds like you do. Sounds like you do want people to have whiplash, Ben.
You know what? If I had to say it, I'll be honest with you. My curmudgeon's coming out. This is a total side note. Has nothing to do with the Z cars, which are fantastic. I think a lot of people fake whiplash. I think a lot of people do.
I think you're right. But how about this?
What?
Noel Whiplash Brown.
Ooh, that's a good one.
That's actually a pretty good one.
No, he doesn't think
maybe
so.
Maybe not. Maybe not. All right. So here's moving on with the Z car story. Uh-huh. The 260Z, there's a little bit more to say about this one.
Yeah.
There was a U.S. version, which was a two-seater only. Mm-hmm. And then there was also in Europe for a while, they built a 260Z that was a 2+2 design. So, that's typically two adults in the front, two kids in the back because way cramped.
We talked about those tiny token back seats.
Exactly right. So these two cars, if you see a U.S. version of the 260Z, which is pretty rare because it was only built for 1 year here.
Right.
Or sold for 1 year here. Mm. And a European version of the 260Z 2+2, you're going to notice that they have dramatically different roof lines. One has a much longer, drawn-out design versus the U.S. design, which is a little bit more abrupt. It drops off.
Yeah, there's
off
a longer
back.
Slope in the European one because they have to squeeze in those quote-unquote back seats.
Well, exactly right. It's got a longer, flatter roof on it, I guess, so just to put it succinctly, I suppose. And other things that we should just mention because these are some improvements over the 240Z that came along the way. And a few of these we mentioned already, but they have improved AC controls, stiffer chassis. There was a rear sway bar that was added. They also had a redesigned dashboard, a new seat trim, and door panels. I know that's all cosmetic stuff. I get it.
They moved the taillights around, too, and part of that was a styling cue, and then another part of it was a result of the bumper legislation we mentioned earlier.
Yeah, yep. And, it's funny. When they mentioned the 260Z specs, they give it the full amount here in the document that I'm looking at. They don't cut it all the way down to the 140 like it was initially. Mm-hmm. So they say that its power is 162 horsepower, which is actually a 10 horsepower increase over the 240Z. And torque is up a little bit as well, up by about 11 pound-feet up to 157 pound-feet. Mm-hmm. Again, these are still carbureted. Now, the original 240Z was carbureted. This one is carbureted as well. We're going to find when we get to the 280Z that changes. I'm sure that's not going to surprise you what they're going to change to. But
so the 240-260Z use twin variable Venturi Hitachi one barrel side draft carburetors. And those carburetors, those specific ones for the 240 and 260, in 1973, they were changed to a different carburetor.
Yeah.
The Weber. Spot on.
So the Weber. And you would think. Now, along the way, when I've been kind of doing little projects on, smaller cars that I that were carbureted, I heard often, the name Weber carbs kind of thrown around that was like an upgrade, right? But that was not necessarily the case with this vehicle, right?
Right. Yeah. The Weber is not exactly an innovation.
Yeah, it wasn't like an upgrade.
No.
The previous or the original carburetor that came with them was actually a better carb.
Yeah.
For performance.
Right. It was superior. So I guess, Scott, at the risk of turning today's episode into an old man get off my lawn rant about emissions,
sure.
I just want to point out that yet again, for the U.S. market, emission regulations were the problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's why they had to do those carburetors.
Well, you're right. And I keep saying stringent, but the stringent U.S. emissions control devices that were added to this thing, the additional requirements for catalytic converters and stuff to kind of scrub the exhaust before it enters the atmosphere.
Right.
All that stuff adds weight to this vehicle. And that was one thing that I found really, really interesting about these cars as I started looking at them. I didn't realize how heavy some of these early Z cars were.
Yeah. So what was the 240Z?
The 1970 240Z is 2,301 pounds. And this one is, again, the same weight, 2,980 pounds for the 260Z. So again, like you said, a 700 pound jump almost.
Mm-hmm.
That's huge. And this thing grows throughout its age, a lot like the Mazda Miata did. And a lot of people have talked about that.
Mm-hmm.
So,
or while we're on the subject, how about the incredible growing Mini Cooper?
I knew you were going to say the Mini Cooper.
Yeah. I just feel like it's weird. Well, don't call it a Mini.
I can't give you the Mini example because I didn't prepare for it.
No, that's fine.
But I can tell you, how the 240, the Z cars have grown over the years, and I can tell you how the Miatas have grown.
Yeah, let's look at that.
All right, so what I think I said earlier was because I'm jumbling this around so much, but the 1970 240Z is about 2,301 pounds, right? That's 1970. Now, if you go through to the modern-day Nissan 370Z, which we'll eventually get to.
Right.
I've got a number here for the 2009 version. It is 3,232 pounds, and that's down from its heaviest weight at 3,602 pounds for the Nissan 350Z in 2002, so they lost weight recently.
Man.
But this thing has grown enormous over the years. Now, I understand why that happened.
That's the pattern, though.
Well, that's always the pattern, and that's the pattern, as we said, with the Mini. Mm-hmm. That's the pattern with the Miata, and I've got numbers for the Miata, as I said. The first-generation Miata in 1989 weighed 2,070 pounds. Now, the fourth generation is down again, so they did the same thing. They cut it down to 2,200 pounds, but it reached a high point in the third generation in 2005 of 2,542 pounds. So this thing gained 500 pounds over just a few years, really. I think it's about 16 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 16 years. Gained more than 500 pounds, and now it's back down again. But the Z cars did the same type of thing. They gained several hundred pounds over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually, like now, it's kind of the trend, I guess, to reduce that, to find ways to cut weight.
It's good that material science is finally starting to catch up with some of that stuff.
Yeah, know? And I know that's a little bit boring, but when you think back to our conversation about the Corvette,
how,
and I found this so fascinating about the Corvette, is that when someone came to the design board, you know, to the design room or whatever, mm-hmm. the studio, with an idea for something to put on this car, they had to fight for that, whatever it was, to be put on the car, because they said, we're going to protest every pound that's added to this vehicle.
Absolutely.
Everything has to be earned. Everything has to be functional in some way. And if you can't find a way to reduce the weight, we're going to work on it until we do find a way to reduce mm-hmm. the weight.
Or so, we're just not going to put it in.
Yeah, and that's the way a lot of these manufacturers are looking now. Nissan is doing that. Mazda is doing that with the Miata.
Mm-hmm.
Chevrolet. You know, they're all seeming to find ways to reduce weight. Not everybody across the board, but sports car manufacturers.
Well, this is something that might be interesting to people. There is a strange parallel between building a sports car and building a rocket. Building a rocket ship, you mm-hmm. know, or a space shuttle, because you have to account for the energy it will take to propel every, really down to like the gram.
Sure.
You know,
yeah.
If you're talking about some more highly sophisticated calculations.
Yeah, it's not simply just a matter of removing the weight. It's like, well, what does that do to the rest of the equation?
Right. You know, yeah. So where is the weight placed? Mm-hmm. To me, this is a fascinating thing that people much, much more intelligent than I are doing on a daily basis. And if you do this for a living, I'd love to hear from you. How do you handle the weight distribution, and how do you handle this strange calculation that you have to do every time?
We talked about aerodynamics in the past, and
yeah.
I think it was the Bugatti Veyron. They said something like it's pretty easy to make a car that'll do 180 miles an hour. And it was like, it only
right.
requires this amount of horsepower and a general aerodynamic shape. But the last 100 miles an hour up to 280,
yeah.
that's where the faster you go, the more wind fights you. And the more wind fights you, the more you have downforce. And the more downforce you have, that, you know, it just goes on and on and on. And there's this big equation where you get to a point where there's no return on that. And that
right.
Power.
It's a diminishing return.
Yes,
exactly.
Yes, yes. So, again, different conversation,
oh,
different podcast.
Different conversation.
So you want to move on to 1975 to 1978? Because it's a big turn here.
Yeah, this is the 280Z. Super famous. The engine size, again, is increased. This time it's 2.8 liters. And they do this by making a bigger bore in the L26 engine. And they make it an L28. Also, the biggest thing, because we were just talking about carburetors, right, Scott?
Yep.
So one of the biggest changes is that this is the first Z with a fuel injection system.
Yeah, they finally switched over to a Bosch L Jetronic fuel injection system with an electric fuel pump. And a few other advances along the way, too. I mean, we're still in the 1970s, so you got to take that at heart. You know, that there's still using that cast iron block. They're still using a single overhead camshaft. But they do have a bigger engine. They do have a lot more power coming out of this thing. I guess not a significant increase, but an increase. It's up to 170 horsepower.
Mm-hmm.
The torque is about 163 pound-feet. And you can get it in a 4-speed manual, you can get a 5-speed manual, or a 3-speed automatic still.
Yeah. Yeah, still. So they're not really messing with some of the things that they've already established that are working, but they do add a couple of different things, and they change some stuff too. One thing that's interesting, this goes to a sidebar too, Scott, if that's okay. So the 280Z doesn't have a full-size spare tire. It has one of those space saver tires. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do. I had a 78 Trans Am that surprisingly had a space saver spare.
So without going into what everybody thinks about space saver spares, other than to say I hope you don't have to ride on one for long, there's a thing that has occurred in recent years that, I'll say it, it bugs the hell out of me. You know, I see these people who just assume, people who are not car people, just assume that there is a spare tire in their car.
I already know what you're going to say.
You know exactly what I'm going to say because it pops, right? You're on the interstate, you're on, I-85 or something, you got to pull over. And so it's your first time looking in your trunk or whatever.
Yeah,
you don't find a spare. Yeah, you pull it back, you do it.
You got to pull back the carpet, right?
Right, open the mat.
Right. And there's going to be a little compartment there, or either off to the side or underneath.
Sure.
And you got to pull that little cardboard piece out and then, lo and behold, here's the big surprise, right? What do you find there?
A can of Fix-A-Flat.
Yeah. And possibly, well, and likely, you'll find a very small electric air pump.
Right, right.
That plugs into your accessory power.
Right, into your power outlet.
Yeah, your old cigarette lighter, I guess, if you call it that.
Do you think people even know those are cigarette lighters that they used to be?
I think it's still generally known.
Okay.
And I think even in some cars they call them cigar lighters. You know, it depends on the level of vehicle that you have.
Right.
Luxury cars.
A luxury car.
A cigar lighter.
Cigar lighter.
Yeah, but,
and the glove box is your caviar cooler. Right?
Generally they're power outlets now.
Right.
And that would be surprising to a lot of people, I think, and especially if you have a sidewall blowout. You're just out of luck.
It's game over. Yeah. Call the tow truck.
Exactly. I've been in, a Pep Boys before when someone comes in looking for a new can of Fix-A-Flat because this is surprising that, their old can has expired. So they're replacing it. And that's really good for them that they're paying attention
to
stuff like
that. Sure, stay on top of your stuff.
Yeah. But, for a lot of people, I think it's a big surprise when they first open that compartment to find that there's no spare tire.
Yeah. It boggles the mind. So even I say that because that bugs the heck out of me, but a space saver spare is still better than a can of Fix-A-Flat.
Yeah, it definitely is, as long as you keep it inflated, right? I mean, that's the other thing is that, some of these cars with the Fix-A-Flat also have run flat tires, that are good for 50 miles with zero air pressure. And that's fine as long as you've got, and I think most of those cars do have the tire inflation warning systems, the sensors in the wheels that tell you got a flat, because otherwise you could drive and not really know, not really understand what's going on.
Oh, so one of the things that they get, though, in sacrificing the space that a full spare would take, they get a larger fuel tank in the 280.
Not bad. That's an okay trade-off. But
I think so.
But it's, I'm sure it's a weight trade-off, but you get to carry more fuel, which is probably important in a car like that, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have the fuel economy numbers for this car specifically, but I'm guessing based on the trend of the mileage increasing for the 260Z, because I think it went up to 20 before or 21. It went up to like 21 to 28 for the 260Z. I would guess that the mileage also went up for this one, but it is a sportier engine, so I don't know. I mean, as far as like more power output,
might be a little thirsty.
Maybe, but I think fuel injection helps that as well. So.
Now you can go into forums and see people's guess on this because
go ahead.
Because I think often you will find that people argue about, essentially they're arguing about their garage baby.
But what I'm talking about is original mileage. And that's why I started to interrupt you, is that
I
think it all depends on what the factory say it would get and what you're getting now, I guess the older way that the EPA would measure this as well, because that's changed along the way too. So there's all these different variables that play into this.
I saw numbers as low as like just under 19 mpg.
that's not terrible, I
guess. That's not terrible.
This is a sports car. It's a sports GT car. So that's kind of expected that you're gonna have the trade-off for the fuel economy with the sportier, you know,
and if you,
performance.
And, you know, when people remove those bumpers, I'm serious, man. They get like a 5% MPG increase.
Yeah, you know, right, because the carryover bumpers, the rubber bumpers, carried over from the 260Z onto the 280Z. And, you know, I think it was that 5 mile per hour, you know, rubber.
Yeah.
You know, traffic friendly bumper. I don't know what to call it really. But also, in addition to that, these U.S. safety emissions or emissions and safety requirements continued to pile onto these cars. And that's why they continued to gain weight along the way. So back to that weight issue that we talked about. And, you know, we should also mention that within the 280Z, production run, I guess, there was a couple of special edition vehicles that we should mention. And those happened in 1977 and 1978.
Oh, okay. I love these.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right. You want to mention them?
The Zap edition in 1977.
Zap.
Yeah. Okay. So they're called Zaps, or a special decor package. Excuse me, folks. The Zaps all had this sunshine yellow paint.
Oh, and black stripes.
And black stripes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that helps a little bit, but sunshine yellow paint, I don't know.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
There were about, a guesstimate would be about 1,000 of these were sold with this special package. Mm-hmm. Or at least were created. And they also had these orange chevrons at the end of the stripes.
Yeah.
So they're a very distinctive car. I don't know about you guys. I'm not really the type to drive a yellow car. Mm. I feel like I would be driving a construction sign.
You mean like a bright yellow car?
Like a
right?
Bright yellow.
Yeah.
Yeah, or even, I don't know, man. I prefer very neutral, I know it's boring, you guys, but like a black car or a gray car. That's
like a blue or maybe a British Racing Green, something like that.
Yeah. But side note, you know, that Escape, your car, the one you have right now is beautiful. It's like a darker, bluish.
Yeah.
Right?
It's a night blue metallic, I think.
Cool. That's cool. I would drive that. Huh. I got this weird, on the Escape, I got this weird paint job. It's a red of some variety. I'm too cheap to change it. But I learned recently, it's kind of dumb, but I learned recently, for some reason, it appears that birds poop more on red cars.
Come on.
Not personal experience. I was reading, so I had to, on this other thing we do at work, I was working on this script about why bird poop is white. And so, of course, I started reading about the effect it can have on cars,
sure.
Right? And the paint on your car. Which,
very damaging.
Yeah, surprise, it's not good for it.
Yeah.
And I kept running into this weird statistic or this weird anecdotal thing where people said, well, you know, birds do understand color and they tend to defecate more on red cars. And I'm sitting there, you know, neck deep in research and going, oh yeah, of course they do, don't they?
I don't buy that. I don't know why I don't buy it, but I don't buy that.
It seems strange. I'm going to look into it. Just if you drive a red car or if you drive more than one car, let us know if there's one that your neighborhood birds seem to appreciate more.
Weigh in on the issue because I'd be interested to find out if you're finding that's the case.
Anyway, Zap cars.
Zap. All right. So there was one other one that we mentioned that happened in 1978 because that previous, the Zap was 1977.
Right.
1978, they came out with a second special edition vehicle. It's called the Black Pearl Edition. Mm-hmm. And this one sounds like it has more promise to me. This one is a black pearlescent paint job and also featured a special appearance package, which had dual racing mirrors. Oh, I like that.
Yeah, it's a little more than the Zap.
Yeah, rear window louvers, which, by the way, I like on any sports car.
Right.
And a unique red and silver stripe, which I'm 50-50 about. Maybe that's okay, but it's estimated that between 750 and 1,500 of these cars were produced. Now, that's a big range.
Yep.
How can they not know how many... what was it? Black Pearl Edition cars they built.
It's weird because for these special decor packages or special appearance packages, there are estimates in both cases, but there aren't concrete numbers.
Yeah.
So I wondered about that too.
I don't know. I don't quite get exactly why that number isn't more accurate.
I'd love to see one in person.
I would. Yeah, I would like to see one too. I may look one up after we
probably.
I'm probably
more a Black Pearl fan than the Zap.
I gotta say you're right. Now you know, moving past this one, I think now that's kind of the end of our. I'm not gonna say it. I'm not going to say the word, but I'm going to say that's the end of 1970s Z cars, really.
Right. Because, the S30 was replaced.
All right, Ben. So basically we're through just the first generation of Z cars. Now we're going to quickly go through the rest, I promise, because the first gen, this is a little confusing. The S30 cars that we mentioned, that actually is three different vehicles. That was the 240Z, the 260Z, and the 280Z. Those are all first gen Z cars, all under the S30 umbrella. Now, the second gen, which begins in 1978, so just at the tail end of the 1970s, these cars are called the S130 cars. And from this point forward, all these generations are going to come much more quickly. It's not going to span 8 years, you know.
Right.
Or it might span that amount of time, but there's not going to be that many variants to it. It's not going to be the 240, the 260, 280. It's going to be a single vehicle or maybe two at most.
Yeah.
So here we are in the second generation, the S130 cars, 1978 to 1983. Nissan, still Datsun, and that's important to mention.
Here we go.
Put together the 280 ZX.
Right, and some people initially were critical about these 280 ZXs for a couple of different reasons. You know, it'll happen whenever you change something that has a lot of loyalty behind it. People will say, the old stuff was better. But here's the thing. The 280 ZX was successful in sales.
Yeah, that's true. But when you get to, also, you got to remember that they also kind of changed the shape of the thing as well.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a bit longer because, you know, they had the 280 ZX. I'm getting these a little confused. 280 ZX two seater, but they also had a 2+2, which we were just now getting to see in the U.S.
Yeah.
And that's a longer design. And people, they're kind of 50-50 about this. You know, they didn't know if they liked it or not. It was not as polarizing as we're probably making it out to be here by any means. But, again, it's kind of a heavy vehicle. It weighs in at something like, you know, 2,824 pounds for the two-seater. And the 2 plus 2 is almost 3,000 pounds.
Yeah, but they also just in their defense from 1980 on, you could also get that T-bar.
Oh, that's true, which isn't bad.
That's cool.
And I got to say, you know, as I think it was Jimmy pointed out, that the T-tops and everything in this car, I had a car that had T-tops and I really enjoyed them. The only problem was the little latches didn't work on them. So at speed, they would kind of flap a little bit.
They seem like it seems like the latches on T-tops are continually breaking.
Well, also, you got to think about this. There's an additional, I don't know, about 9 feet of seals that that can leak above you. And
a lot of
people don't think about that. You know, these rubber seals that were built in, you know, the late 1970s, not the best things, you know, for keeping water out,
right.
You know, when it's really a deluge, you know, like it's one thing to have a leaky sunroof, but when you've got all that material above you that can leak, and they often did.
Then you have to maintain it, you know, the weather can wear.
That was trouble. Yeah,
well,
it just seemed to be trouble.
So 1980, something interesting happens.
Yeah.
The 10th anniversary car comes out.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is just a, this is another, you know, cosmetic package. They build about 3,000 of the cars. Most were in black and gold.
Yeah, with gold emblems.
Yeah, red two-tone paint. And then they had leather seats and other kind of special goodies.
Yeah, and you know what? Still selling well because they sold something like 500,000 units, which isn't bad at all. I mean, that's pretty big. And you know what? One thing that I haven't really said along the way here, and I just want to just throw this out there as a general blanket statement is
and
that
you mean when you say 500,000, you mean the ZX, the 280 ZX, not the anniversary edition.
No, exactly right. I mean the ZX cumulative Z sales,
right.
Z car sales.
Yeah, yeah.
But I also want to throw this out there, and this is just for all the Z cars, you know, from the beginning to end, like from 1969 through today.
Uh huh.
These cars have been so successful. They've got such a successful racing history. They sell well. They've won lots of awards along the way. You know, some big magazines have given them top awards along the way. It's a popular car. It's a really good car. It's well put together. I don't mean to sound like a commercial for Nissan Datsun, but it's going to come off that way. But national championships for different racing series, you know, like C Production Series.
Right.
You know, IMSA championships and SCCA championships and GTO championships, GTU championships, just a number of these along the way. Paul Newman drove these. Bob Sharp and Scott Sharp drove these.
Rated as some of the best cars per decade, bar none. In the 1990s, I know I'm skipping ahead a little bit, the 300 ZX is listed as one of the top 10 sports cars. And in the 1970s, the OGZ, the 240Z, is listed as the number two best car of the 1970s.
I still like OG for Noel's nickname.
Yeah, me too. I think I'm sold on
that. All right, well, maybe we'll just stick with that one.
So, hey, pop quiz, though. Do you want to guess what the number one car of the 1970s was?
All right, Ben. I know this is probably a setup, but I'm going to go ahead and say it's one of the Datsun or Nissan Z cars.
You know, that is a respectable answer, and I do know this is a pop quiz, but I'm not clever enough to try to trick people that way. I'm flattered, but I'm not clever enough.
Well, you're tricking me by making it another vehicle. Not that you made it another vehicle, but, you know, that it is another vehicle.
The Ferrari Daytona. That's the one it is.
The most popular sports
that's
car.
That's number one.
Most popular or
most, the best sports car of 1970s.
Oh, I see.
Which you could tell by that poll, it's a little bit subjective.
Sure.
Let me just go out and say that.
Just a little bit?
Just a bit.
Okay.
But that's, you know, that's according to, the Sports Car International poll.
All right. Well, you fooled me. All right, Ben, so I think we should get back into the Z car discussion here, and we're picking it up with the third generation of Z car, and that is from 1983 to 1989. This is called the Z31, and
otherwise known as the 300ZX.
Yeah, 300ZX, you're right, and that's a very popular model, but it still looks a lot like those first and second generation vehicles, those first and second gen Z cars.
Yeah.
Now, Nissan has completely, and I should say this, somewhere along the line in 1985, so right in the middle of this third generation vehicle, Nissan drops the Datsun badge completely worldwide. So they're not referred to as Datsuns anymore, so there's none of that confusion, you know, is this the Nissan here in this market? Is this the Datsun? It's totally gone worldwide, and they've done it to standardize the brand name. But they did retain the rights to use that Datsun name, as we found out back in 2013 with that economy car episode that we did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So they did bring it back, but they dropped it for this because they wanted to standardize all their cars to be just called Nissans at that point. So that happened in 1985.
Yeah, and additionally, there are, outside of just that badge dropping, there are a lot of under-the-hood changes that take place. This marks the introduction of Japan's first mass-produced V6. I think you could still get both an inline and a V.
Yeah, inline and a V, and you could also get a turbo version of the inline and a V. So mm-hmm. you get a turbo V6 and inline turbo as well.
Right. Have we talked about the special editions of these yet?
We have not.
Okay, good. Cause I got all these special edition notes and I'm getting,
let's have
getting lost a little bit. All right. So there were two special editions of the Z31 Gen. One was a 50th anniversary edition. It just had some more luxury features. That was in 84. And then there was the Shiro Special, which came out in 88 and actually had some performance upgrades.
Now, I need to clarify something.
Yeah.
I think that 50th anniversary edition that you're talking about is actually the 50th anniversary of Nissan, right? Not of – or Datsun Nissan, not of the Z cars. Of course.
Right.
Or the
yeah.
Fair, or even the Fairlady.
Right, right,
of cars,
right, right.
Because that comes later in 2010. I think mm-hmm. they've got the 40th anniversary. Mm-hmm. So, okay, that makes sense. And then, where do you want to go? You want to go from there? We're at the Nissan 300ZX, which is the third gen. We can go up to the fourth gen, which is from 1989 to 2000.
Yeah.
And this is an all new design, right?
Yeah. This is a brand new kid on the block.
Mm-hmm. And this is the Z32, you know, following on the heels of the Z31. And this is also called the Nissan 300ZX as well, but it's kind of like the second version of this car.
Right.
But they still do call it the fourth generation vehicle. So,
yeah.
Built from, I think it was 1989 to 2000, as I said.
Mm-hmm.
And this one is a radically different style.
Yeah, the body's wider. It's rounder. That's one of the first things you notice when you look at it. Its drag is actually a little bit increased. So under the hood, it has some normal things. But when you look at it, okay, let me put it this way. I know a lot of people are not going to agree with this, but one of the first things one of my buddies said when he saw it was this years ago, when Saturn came out afterwards, he said, "Wow, that looks like a busted."
No way!
Yeah.
Oh boy!
In the front.
I don't think that at all.
I don't agree. I don't agree. But I can kind of see what he's talking about with the way they changed the headlights.
Okay. All right. You know what?
In the front.
Now that you're saying it, I can look at this photo that I'm looking at here in front of me of the the Z32.
I've just reviewed
Z car, and yeah. It's tough to put those two together because they're nothing alike.
They are nothing.
But
alike.
I do see what he's saying. If you stretched it left to right. You stretched it out.
Yeah.
It's a possibility that it could have come from the same vehicle.
I think he just didn't like Saturns.
apparently didn't like Nissan Z cars either. I mean, to compare it to that. But anyways, when you said some usual things under the hood, I mean, they had a V6, but they also had a twin turbo V6 at this point, which is a big deal.
Yeah.
And there was a lot more to this too. I mean, I know a lot of people bought this vehicle because maybe the Porsche at the time was a little too much for them, and they thought, well, this has got similar performance, and it really did. Not, of course, the 911 Turbo or any of that, mm-hmm. I understand, but there were models of Porsche that were available at the time that were comparable, and some people, I know one guy that bought one of these, that bought it specifically for, like, autocross racing, mm-hmm. you know, taking it to the track, just having fun with it. And I think the question was he going to buy a Porsche Boxster, which was available then, or is he going to buy this? And he went with this instead and was very happy with it for a long, long time. I know he held on to it too.
Oh man, yeah. And just to give us a comparison to the earlier, to the 240, this vehicle now has a 0 to 60 time that depending on who you ask, is probably a better way to say it, mm-hmm. somewhere between 5 and 6 seconds. It has a top speed of 155 miles per hour, and that is with a governor, my friend.
With a governor.
Yeah.
So you can drop that off, you know, tune these things to whatever you want.
Really. One thing we would definitely say is don't feel like you have to do that.
That's a safe way to cover our rears on that one,
but
I guess.
But it is your car.
You could do that if you wanted to do that. But now we get to a point where there's a two-year break in production. That's from 2000 to 2002, mm-hmm. Before we get to the fifth generation, which, again, is an all-new design. Now, I think this is the one, and I just read this somewhere along the way, so I hope I'm not mixing this up, but I think this is the redesign for the 350Z, and this is a big deal, this launch, to bring back the 350Z. After the two-year, you know, drop in production or layover in production, called the Z33. And again, all new design, but I think this is the one that came around just after Renault bought about 44% of the Nissan stock. So that's kind of a big deal, is that maybe it was Renault pushing them to say, let's get back into the Z car game because we know that can sell. We know that'll make some money for the company.
That makes perfect sense.
And people love it.
Yeah.
So let's do that. So I think that was, again, I hope I'm not mixing up that with the fourth gen, but I think that was the fifth gen. And then on to the sixth gen, which is, a lot of people have a hard time distinguishing the fifth gen and the sixth gen. The sixth gen, which is the present generation, is this 370Z. And there's a few cosmetic differences you can look for. One that I always look for, and I learned this somewhere along the way, Ben, is that it's very similar to 350Z except for the headlight design and the taillight design.
Yeah.
And when you look at them, if you think about it this way, you know, one versus the other one, the 370 has more of a boomerang shape to the front light and the taillight compared to the 350Z. And that's really one way to quickly distinguish the two in traffic. But I know there's a lot of other changes along the way. I mean, other things that distinguish them.
Mm-hmm.
One thing would be that, you know, there's a 7-speed automatic offered that wasn't prior to this. And a 6-speed manual, but I think the 6-speed manual is also available on the 350Z. There's other cosmetic changes, you know, along the way. The body is slightly different in other places. But again, the headlamps and the tail lamps are just the easy, quick way to identify them in traffic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when we're talking about traffic, speaking of amazing segues, let's talk about racing.
Oh, that is an amazing segue.
Oh man, you know, I look at it the way I look at land and planes. Any segue you can walk away from. All right,
let's walk away from that one.
Let's walk away.
Ah, see, that was funny. That was almost like a Muppets moment right there. You know?
Oh man,
like the old curmudgeons in the audience or something.
You're pushing me.
Yeah,
you
know,
you push people, Scott. Okay, yeah. So racing, we have to talk about racing because the awards and recognition that you see this vehicle getting they exist both in the world of racing and they exist in just the world of car reviews,
like street cars.
Yeah, like street cars. So 1995 GTS 300 ZX car debuts at Daytona, and it ends up placing first in the GTS 1 class at the 12 Hours of Sebring.
That is also the 25th anniversary edition of the 300 ZX, I believe, right?
Yeah. Is it? It is.
It is, yeah.
And, you know, Scott, we're at a weird point because we need to wrap this up. I think we went kind of long. I probably shouldn't talk more about the racing or the various accolades. So I just want to do a quick laundry list. Just in the 2000s, Automobile named Z32 one of the 100 greatest cars of all time. They also listed it in 2006 as the 20 greatest cars of the past 20 years, 25 most beautiful cars in history. In 2010, GQ magazine listed the Z32 as one of the most stylish cars over the past 50 years. It has won multiple comparison tests against other cars. It's like the Mitsubishi 3000 GT, Dodge Stealth, the Corvette, Toyota Supra, Dodge Viper. It's a lot of stuff.
You know, if you want to get just a really good handle on the year-by-year changes that happen to these vehicles from 1966 all the way through present day, really, you can go to a place called the Z-Car Club Association. And
yeah, that's great.
ZCCA.org. And, they have a Z-Car timeline that's very helpful. And we've referenced it along the way here, but it'll tell you things like national championships and national titles and drivers that drove these cars to those titles and, the year by year changes, even some of the prices along the way, you know, like, some interesting facts, like, you know, the 240Z, debuted with an initial price tag of just $3,526, but just a few months later, people were so excited about this car that just a few months later in 1970, Kelley Blue Book rated this car a used Z car at $4,000. So it went up $500 in just a few months in 1970. I think that's a huge move. Things like that along the way, and I'll tell you, you know, the number of units sold per year, and it's just a really good timeline. So again, go to ZCCA.org and check that out. And there's lots of information elsewhere. I know we always say this, Ben, but we have probably not done these cars justice because there's way more than this. And I know we've probably muddied the waters in some of the generations and some of the changes that happened throughout, you know, like things that we did cover, things that we didn't cover, things that we should have covered, things that we covered that we maybe shouldn't have.
Sure. Long list.
Yeah. Well, you know, it happens every time we get off on side conversations, you know, that lead different places and that happens along the way, but
I have no regrets. That stuff about Fix-A-Flat needed to be said. It's a swindle. It's a scheme.
It is. It's a total scam.
And with that, ladies and gentlemen, it looks like Noel the OG Brown is giving us a "What are you guys doing?" nod again, which means we're having entirely too much fun here. We need to head out, and before we do, we just want to make a few announcements. First, if you want to check out more episodes of our show, you can visit carstuffshow.com and see every episode we have ever done. Literally, I know it sounds too good to be true.
All in one spot.
All in one spot. And furthermore, if you want to check out some of our stories that never make it to the air for one reason or another, or you'd like to talk to us directly, check us out on Facebook and Twitter, where we are Car Stuff HSW. And if you would like to email a topic to us, take a page from Jimmy's book out there in L.A., but you don't want to deal with the social media baloney, we get it. Send us an email directly. All our best suggestions come from our listeners. Our address is
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, "Well, I had this career before, but it was a waste." And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Discover a new educational and interactive podcast, Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids. Our episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We went shape hunting around the block, and we found spheres and cubes on the street.
That was great fun. Join Stories for Kids, the Lingo Kids podcast, inspiring you to learn while having fun. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.